Dr. David DeRoff is the executive director at Coacoonaby Valley Family Services, and he's been there for the last 20 years. He comes to us from Minnesota, but he's been here in Hawaii for a long time. Let's see, he's board certified in general preventive medicine, and in 1989 he moved to Hawaii to pursue public health training and received his MPH from the University of Hawaii. He serves as a board member. I think he wears many, many hats, and this includes serving as a board member for the Association of Asian and Pacific Island Community Health Organizations. He serves on numerous committees, and in 2008 he received the Hawaii Community Foundation Wallace Alexander Gerbaud Foundation Ho'okele Award for Nonprofit Leadership. He's a member of the inaugural class of the California Hawaii Public Health Leadership Institute in 2009. And I think they're going to tell us a little bit more about that. And then Dr. James Rarick is currently the executive director of the Hawaii Public Health Association. He's from California, but has also been in the Pacific and in Hawaii for a long time. He did his undergraduate work at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, and received his master's degree in public health from the University of Hawaii. He served as the president of the Hawaii Public Health Association from 2006 to 2009, and he also recently completed the year-long California-Hawaii Public Health Leadership Institute. So welcome, both of you. Thank you for coming. And you know, I went and pondered about this for a long time. Should I get them laid? Should I not get them laid? And in the end, I decided to get you guys a little plant as a symbol of renewal and growth. And thank you for both of them.
Association, and also Dr. David Liu, who is our president, Kavika Liu, who is our president of the Hawaii Public Health Association. And Kavika is also trying now to head up developing our policy agenda, and is a good guy to talk to if any of this stimulates you in thinking a little bit about policy and has an interest in that. As May has mentioned, David and I are both the graduates of the inaugural class of the California Hawaii Public Health Leadership Institute, and what this was led by the Public Health Institute, which is a national organization supported by the Hawaii Community Foundation on the Hawaii side and the California Endowment on the California end, as well as CDC. And this is a photograph of our cohort, minus one individual, I believe. And our focus in the Leadership Institute, besides just covering basic leadership skills, was looking at health equity and chronic disease. And it was a wonderful experience, I think most of us feel like a life-changing experience in many ways in looking at these things. And it gave us an opportunity to rub shoulders, as David is literally doing right there, with Dr. Tony Eit and some of the leading experts in this area, that we really gained a lot of great insights and got a lot of resources. The Institute, the members of the cohort were appointed by the Director of Health, and our cohort was a little different than the California cohort, which was all members of the Department of Health. Dr. Fukino here in Hawaii decided that she wanted to have five people from inside the department and five external of the department, so which we felt was, at the end of the day, was really a great idea. And so we had two executive directors of community health centers. Dave was one of those, an executive director of the Native Hawaiian Health System of Maui, and Deanne Carpenter from the Department of Native Hawaiian Studies. And on the Department of Health side, one of the things that came out of this institute for us, we were asked to do some kind of projects around health disparities. And the cohort inside the Department of Health decided that they wanted to basically survey and see what the current knowledge was and awareness about social determinants of health and health equity was within the Department of Health. So they did that. They developed a survey. Our project was, the Ho'okahi project, which we wanted to develop a curriculum based on unnatural causes, which I'll talk about in a minute, that was more kind of focused on Hawaii. Now, the institute has now ended. Unfortunately, with the economic downturn, Hawaii Community Foundation on our side has been unable to continue and bring in another cohort. And we've agreed that this is really important work, that we will stay together for the time being. And actually, one of our projects is to see if we could find the resources to continue this leadership institute, a leadership institute that's Hawaii-based and not dependent on a mainland institute to run it, which is a big challenge, but we really feel it's very important. So when I call this a series, this is a work in progress. We're trying to really pull together much of what we have learned, and we beg, borrow, and steal shamelessly from whoever we can in terms of getting the data. Some of the slides that I've got in here I've actually borrowed from the Heiuliau conference that happened last week. I don't know if you were at that conference, and many of you might have been there. We look forward to getting your feedback on how we can improve this as we move forward. Now, since I'm speaking to a bunch of physicians, I thought it might be appropriate to start with this quote from Carl Virchow, who's one of the, I consider, fathers of public health. When I look back, public health really grew out of the fact that physicians who were treating people on an individual level started to wonder, well, why do all these people come from one neighborhood, or why is it that I'm seeing all these problems? So, you know, Virchow, towards the latter part of his career, and you see this is also not a new idea, and that's one of the points I wanted to make, is this idea that social determinants of health have a lot to do with whether we're healthy or not. But his view was that medicine is a social science, and as a science of human beings, has the obligation to point out problems and to attempt their theoretical solution. So again, beyond treating the individual, what can be done to understand why people get sick? So our objectives for today are really to sort of understand this, the link between historical and current policies and the social inequities that develop out of those policies and the health inequities that we actually see in our community today. And hopefully we can also identify for here in Hawaii some opportunities for action and finding solutions. And action oftentimes boils down to policy. You know, what are the policies that can make a difference? And then, of course, again, we'd like to gain your feedback on how we can make this a little bit better. So looking at these social determinants of health, I'm kind of curious, since I'm sitting here with a room full of physicians and people who are soon to be physicians, is there anything about this list as you look through these determinants of health that may strike you? Or that you?
It's actually missing one. Indigenous status is a prime determinant of health.
Okay. So if you all heard that, Kavika was saying indigenous status is another indicator that we need to add to this list. Anything else that again, as a physician, when you look at this? Well, for me, as I look at that, there's really only one thing there that maybe deals with what you guys deal with on a sort of a daily basis, and that's access to services. Everything else, income, housing, education, transportation, is not necessarily your kuleana as a physician. So one of the things is, you know, oftentimes you're dealing with the result of all these problems. But as doing that, you're the ones who often do see exactly what all these things, how they impact a person's health.
Except that, you know, for community pediatrics advocacy, and Kazumi had just finished up her rotation. Right, Fair? Kazumi, you spent your rotation looking at all of those determinants, going to the home, working with the community, and so we are trying to change our training for our young residents at this point.
Yeah, and I appreciate that comment, and I do know that the JAPSM now has a social justice interest group, which is raising awareness about these kinds of issues beyond just, you know, medical treatment.
And we've got some of them represented here today.
For me, you know, personally, while there's been a lot of discussion over the last year over, the medical reform, and it's a critically important issue for our country, From my standpoint and my involvement with HPHA and my interest, it is really much more upstream than that. You know, knowing that that will solve some of the problems, but it will not necessarily have a huge impact on health disparities. So this idea of what is a health disparity versus a health inequity, I think it's important to go through this. And this is a HRSA definition, you know, and really the disparities. And I spent most of my career, you know, talking about and dealing with, you know, supposedly disparities. And we really look at the measure of the health outcomes, access to care, the presence of disease. We look at rates of disease, and we talk about the rates are different from one population for another. Health equity is the absence of systematic disparities in health or the major social determinants of health between groups with different social advantage or disadvantage. So health inequities are really the presence of those kinds of differences, whether a person lives in a place that makes it easy to be healthy or not, has the access to be healthy, to the things that they need to be healthy. And then this is the framework that we used a lot in the Institute, just sort of showing this. And again, most of you are working over here in the medical model, where you've got the downstream issues. You know, you've already got disease and injury, higher mortality rates, risk factors, and behaviors, versus the social ecological model, which is concerned with the neighborhoods that people live in, you know, institutional power that impacts all of these things. And I think, you know, I have to admit, you know, I've spent my career in public health, but an awful lot of what I've done in public health has been on the right side here, has been the disparities. I spent the last 7 years of my career working for the National Cancer Institute's Cancer Information Service. We're all about disparities. What do we spend most of our time doing? Raising awareness to get people to be screened for cancer so that they can get screened early, we can catch the disease, and then we can treat them. Now, is that going to really make a difference of whether they get cancer or not? If they have a poor diet, if they, you know, if they don't exercise, if they have other issues on the upstream side, not really. And that's been one of the large paradigm shifts for me in going through the Leadership Institute, is thinking about even what I do in a public health supposedly prevention program, what am I preventing? You know, we screen people and we treat them. That means that they get into treatment earlier, but it doesn't really make the difference in terms of whether we've done anything about the health inequities that lead to cancer. So how many of you have seen unnatural causes? Please raise your hand. Okay. You know, this is one of the things that, this is a program that was done by California Newsreel. Actually, Dr. Neil Palafox, if any of you know him, was one of the people that was featured in the program. There's a 50-minute segment that sort of is the broad piece, and then there are several modules. We were each given a copy of Unnatural Causes. And one of the things that with HPHA that we're doing is making sure we provide our board members on the neighbor islands with copies of this. This does a really excellent job of really discussing what are the underlying factors in terms of the gap that we're seeing, the ever-growing gap in terms of health outcomes here in this country. Much of it, as you'll see when David talks, has a lot to do with not necessarily healthcare, access to healthcare, but just distribution of wealth in this country. Again, we want to continue to describe this, how this is playing out in Hawaii. So one of the things that Unnatural Causes talks a lot about is that social position matters. Education and income, of course, are the markers of that socioeconomic position. People with lower socioeconomic position are more likely to have worse access to health care. But beyond just access to health care, which is often what we always hear about, you know, we heard from Josh Green at the Heiau about how bad it is that they don't have enough physicians and things on the Big Island. But, you know, social position also influences whether you're going to be exposed to a health risk and whether you are going to have any resources that might buffer that health risk. So place matters. We heard an awful lot about this. Back on the first slide, Tony Eitan has done a lot of really groundbreaking work as the director of the Department of Health in Alameda County, Oakland, California, and looking at, you know, the differences between neighborhoods, access to recreation, safe places. These slides, you know, we live on Oahu. All of us know that they have great bike paths for those of us who like to ride bikes, you know, going all the way from Kahala to do Hawaiian Kai and Kailua and things like that. But the lower picture is Farrington Highway, and we know that Farrington Highway is the highest accident rate, and we know that the neighborhoods in Hawaii don't have, and why not on the Waianae Crest, don't have great, sidewalks and things like that. So safe neighborhoods, being able to use things. This was a slide that I stole from the Heihuliao conference on the Pilio Hana Project study, and they've sort of confirmed this, not just in terms of sidewalks and safe roads, but the availability of fast food outlets. And I've always, when I've driven along the Waianae coast, been struck by the fact that every few hundred yards there's a McDonald's, Burger King, and these things. And so, they've really verified in the communities that they looked at with the Native Hawaiian communities, which were Waianae, Kahuku, and Waimanalo, that they found that there were greater numbers of those food outlets. And while these, public health, there were also more exercise facilities in the more affluent communities. And the facilities in these other places were more run down. It's hard to play basketball when there's no rim on the goal. So the other thing is, they found this, Tobacco-Free Kids, which is a national organization, has seen this with tobacco. They've documented that the tobacco companies go in and they target low SES communities. And there's more advertising in those communities. There's more aggressive attempts to sell their products there. And I think you would probably see the same thing with Coca-Cola and many of the other things. They know where they can sell their cheap products. So the conclusions that they came up with were that these obesogenic environmental factors really do correlate to population trends in obesity in the communities that they looked at. Race matters, and I think in Hawaii, oftentimes, we downplay racial discrimination, but it certainly contributes to things, especially stress, the stress that goes along with it, and develops a sort of a chronic stressor that contributes to poor health that are independent of some of the other factors that we looked at. We heard a lot about that at the Heihuliao conference with the metabolic syndrome, the cortisone levels that remain high. And this is, again, sort of sometimes the conventional wisdom is that, wouldn't it be the CEOs and the people in the really top positions that have a lot of stress because they're responsible for a lot? I don't know, Chris, maybe you can speak to that. but the truth is, people in those positions have a lot of control over their lives. And Unnatural Causes talks about this a lot. It's a lot about the control that you have and the ability that you have to manage that stress. And many people who are disempowered, and the Native Hawaiian community has been saying this for many, many years, the stress that goes with loss of culture, loss of power in your own community is an ongoing stress that you are not able to get rid of. And there is a wealth of studies now, primate studies as well as in humans. One of the most famous studies that's talked about in Unnatural Causes, the Whitehall study that was done in England, in which they measured cortisone levels across in the civil service. And it basically, the lower you were in the pecking order, the higher those levels were. So this is a real major factor in the development of chronic diseases. It's now being recognized. Again, this is not a huge revelation, but people with lower socioeconomic status have higher levels of this chronic stress and have fewer resources to deal with the stress. And I wanted to mention, this is an excellent resource that kind of challenges the view of Hawaii as a multicultural model of ethnic tolerance and equality. And of course, we like to push that to the world because we want people to come to Hawaii and feel safe here and feel that it's a great place. But John Okamura is a professor of ethnic studies at the University of Hawaii, and he really focuses on several things in his book. Particularly, he has a chapter on economic development in Hawaii, our sort of single-minded push for tourism as the one thing that we hang our economic hat on, and then also on education and the differences in the educational opportunities and how they've played out in Hawaii. And now I'm not going to spend a lot of time, here today talking and trying to convince people about that there's differences between, health outcomes between the races. I think most everybody here knows this already. Bottom line is that death rates are higher for Hawaiians and lower for the Japanese and Chinese, and we really can show this, you know, in terms of, and certainly, you know, I've done a lot of my work in the Pacific over the years, and if you look at the Micronesian population and the people coming from the U.S. API populations, they're living, you know, 10, 15 years shorter than what the white and Japanese and Chinese population lives, you know, enjoys in Hawaii. John spends a lot of time looking at the public school systems, and the main thing about this is Hawaii, you know, we really just, as a society in Hawaii, don't seem to value public education. And we're seeing that in the news a lot now as economic times get hard, we start to furlough the kids, but as a percentage of state and local funds allocated to the K-12 public health education in Hawaii, that's continued to decline from 1987, 88, all the way up through 92, and I imagine if you continue to look at that, it's continuing to decline. You know, despite the fact that Hawaii, the average spending on public education is below average compared to the nation, Hawaii continues to be a relatively wealthy state. We have the third, we are third in the nation in per capita spending and local government revenues, and fourth in per capita state and local government expenditures, but we don't spend it on education. And in fact, we also have the highest K-12 private school enrollment in the nation. And somebody made the comment today that something like 70% of the teachers send their kids to private school in Hawaii. And, you know, so there's this idea that the public schools, it's like if you can afford to get yourself out of the public school, you do. We don't really value that and sending that. Now, who are the kids? And John talks also a lot in his book about what are the things that just determine success, graduation rates, things like that in schools. School size, where are the biggest schools? Campbell, Waianae, you know, they're in the communities that are already low SES schools, and this is all related to school connectedness and safety and things like that that go along with that. But so this is just feeding, it's feeding the problem. So since we're talking about obesity, a little bit about obesity, and I, again, sort of stole in some of these slides. So, but we know, and I don't think it's any news to anybody, that, you know, we've been seeing this obesity epidemic that's been going, you know, obesity, overweight amongst the adolescents has more than tripled since the 1960s. This is just national data, and I stole this slide from May's presentation at the conference, you know, looking at by ethnicity. And as you can see, as the ethnicities, the differences in the race for the ethnicity versus non-Native Hawaiian,
non-Hispanic
white, 26, and it just continues to increase, and Pacific Islanders, Native Hawaiians are far and away the much higher rates in the bottom. But Kavika and I were having this discussion at the beginning before everybody came in, is, you know, a lot of researchers are sort of looking now at maybe the social context is more important than race. At least we need to look at the fact that, you know, and there's study, one of this particular study was looking at, you know, analyzing studies between black women who are nationally have twice the rate of obesity as white women. But when they sort of look at it across social economic factors, those differences were much less significant. So, you know, social context, again, is important. Very important thing, and I apologize for the business of those slides. But so, if we start looking again, you know, at these social determinants of health and looking at education, and looking at we've seen the increases continue unabated across all categories. But the categories again are highest for those who lower education. And you know, the one thing that hopefully everybody in the field of health now understands is that education levels are closely related to health. You know, I mean, if the lower your education, you can see the gradient. And if you don't graduate high school, you're not going to live as long as the people that graduate high school. It's that simple. And in many cases, you may not live. It's significant in terms of the years of life lost, simply by that one indicator of education. No. So in terms of the current state of child obesity in Hawaii, I think we really need to work on defining this a little bit better, and I stole this slide from Ann Pabutsky at the Heihuliao conference. So the one point I wanted to make, though, that is, again, in Hawaii as everywhere else, it's been increasing. And one of the things that Ann was saying is, and May, you can help me with this, is there hasn't been a great increase from, I think, 2005 to 2007 in the overweight category, but there's a significant increase, 2 or 3% in the obese category. And that data's not out yet, but it's coming out. And that's the category we're most worried about. I mean, the obesity is the one that, you know, is going to be leading to the serious health problems. So it's a major concern. So again, just looking at, you know, the poverty status here and obesity rates from 2003 and 2007, they've increased, but, you know, obviously significantly higher, I mean, almost twice as much obesity in under 100% of poverty as compared to the 400% of poverty. You know, so, you know, again, maybe no revelation for anybody here, but, you know, if you want to really address obesity, are we going to be able to do it with brochures to tell people to eat right, or are we going to be able to, you know, try to think about the underlying causes for that? Another thing that we, if anybody's looked at the food bank's reports coming out from Hawaii, the food bank has gone through something like a 40% increase in utilization over the last year or two. And what kind of food do people get from the food bank? They don't get fresh fruits and vegetables. They don't get high fiber foods. They get canned foods. So the foods that people have available to them, and you know, I mean, it's not a, we have this really high calorie, high fat foods that are really inexpensive. And that's what people can afford. And if you're working two jobs, you're going to go, you don't want to go home and fix a healthy meal. You're going to go and get what you can fill yourself up with that you can afford. So that's what's driving this epidemic, really. Another study that looked at this, and the main thing about this was, you know, the odds of a child being obese or overweight were 20 to 60% higher among children in neighborhoods with the most unfavorable social conditions. But especially, these effects were found to be much greater for females and younger children. So for folks working with those populations, this is a big concern. And then this is another slide I stole from May. But this was looking at basically across neighborhoods, what were the higher, what were the obesity. So you're looking over here at the obesity, or percent obese or overweight. And if you look at what neighborhoods are we looking at, Farrington, Kahuku, Wailua, Waipahu, I can't read that one, Honoka'a, this is statewide, West Kauai, this must be on the Big Island, oh, and Lanai, and Lahaina Luna. So you compare that with the ones which are not, are much significantly lower, and where are they? Kaiser, Kalani. My son went to Kalani. He's one of the overweight kids, actually. He's Fijian and he played football. But, you know, some of this going back to race, you know, Kalani's a lot of Asian kids. That's why they haven't won a football game in like 500 years. You know, but I mean, also, you know, and the thing is, you know, this is, I like this slide, because it starts to show that place matters, you know, and we all recognize, those of us who are trying to do this work and get the word out, that we need to do a better job of showing how that plays out. And we've got great examples of how they've done this in other communities, but we need to make this understood that this is a big part of what's going on, you know, on the economic and social conditions in these communities. So at this point, this is where David gets to take over and
talk about thank that. Thank you, James. All right, thank you. You can certainly have to take any notes with what I'm going to say. I'm primarily interested in just opening all of our minds a little bit about how we conceive of a problem facing our community like obesity. Like many of you as a physician, I find it to be a personally very frustrating problem to deal with. I think as physicians, we are most often working with single individuals, sometimes we're fortunate with families to address this. But the tools of our trade for a problem like obesity when we've limited ourselves to dispensing advice, we're finding our altogether too often unsuccessful. We must have some successes periodically, or we wouldn't continue to do it. And in fact, you know, because the evidence doesn't support at all. I mean, the dispensing advice is a very effective intervention. One of the things I'd like us to all think about is why do we continue to do things that haven't been shown to work? In thinking about that, then I one of the ways of addressing this is to ask us all to invert the microscope. As physicians, we approach things in a very reductivist mindset. We have been taught to try to zero in on the one or two factors that might be most responsible for causing a problem. But I would like to argue that this sort of reductionism has its limits and its drawbacks. You know, if we consider some of the things that James has just mentioned and some of the leading causes of what the evidence supports as being leading causes of obesity, looking at them as individual factors, we would see things like neighborhood social conditions or the built environment. The availability and affordability of fresh produce, sharing meals together as a family, excessive TV and internet viewing, inadequate sleep, particularly for children under the age of two. Sleep patterns have been strongly associated with development of obesity. Recently, some of you, I think, are getting exposed to some of the theories surrounding fructose poisoning. High fructose corn syrup consumption has gone up dramatically over the last 20 years. I don't know if any of you are following some of the effects, studies that are coming out on the effects of BPA in our environment and how it affects hormonal regulation in our body, and some people think could contribute to obesity. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The list is long and somewhat overwhelming. And I think although any number of these may be worthy candidates for us to focus our energies on, at the end of the day, we really only have so much time. And at the end of the day, if we stand back and look at some of these things, we're going to find that there's a common denominator running through many of them. When I invert the microscope and I say, okay, this we've had now 30 years of an incredible growth trend in obesity. Is that happening in isolation? No, I'm just looking out around ourselves in our society. What else have we seen? Well, this is kind of a fun slide. I don't know if you can see this, but this is the size of the Honda Accord. This is the Honda Accord. You know, these are engine size and its weight and et cetera. The Honda Accord has gotten, you know, just it looks like a chart of obesity. Humor me a little bit. You know, I am. You're going to say, well, really, David, is that a spurious association between car size growth and obesity? But, you know, think about it. If you step back and think about our culture of the car, what's the opposite of a big car? It's not a small car. It's a bicycle or walking. We don't have communities where people can walk to work, walk to the grocery store, walk to a park, and get out and play with their kids. Our home size. Here is a chart which overlays the size of the American home with obesity. Are we growing to fit our homes, or are our homes growing to fit us? But again, I don't think anyone's going to go out and research whether increasing the size of homes actually has made us obese. But where are we building homes? We're building in suburban communities which are not designed to walk in. by and large. And there's been good data, particularly coming out of Canada now, where they've really looked at at-risk populations who are living in much more densely populated inner-city areas, but which where there are good walkability indexes and the like. And those areas are doing surprisingly well in obesity compared to the suburban areas of those same cities. This is a chart of total U.S. net borrowing. I mean, we are a consumer society, and we have run up some huge tabs on that, and our debt has grown, you know, almost exponentially from 1978 to recently. And I think the best thing we can say about this trend is that it's not sustainable. And that's not a typo. I mean, I don't know how many of you saw the CEO of Goldman Sachs give a talk a couple months ago in which he argued that they were doing God's work. You know, this is a Goldman Sachs' profits have clearly had a severe growth trend. I would argue that this is part and parcel. Our U.S. military expenditures since 2001. This is in billions of dollars. If we're spending $750 billion a year on U.S. military expenditures, how much money do we have left for good schools and neighborhoods? Here's a chart showing the ratio of CEO pay to the average worker pay. Back in 1965, America was a relatively egalitarian society. We had a ratio of 24. This graph peaks at 300. I'm told the newest numbers will again have us over 300 because the average worker's salary is actually declining while the top worker's salaries are soaring exponentially. Second thing I wanted to tease people with is some thinking about what are some of the challenges that face us in addressing some of the underlying causes of problems like obesity. There's a long list of them. The one I would like to talk about today is this issue of personal responsibility versus public intervention. And I love this quote from the CEO of Coca-Cola recently. And he said, Americans need to be more active and take greater responsibility for their diets. Imagine Jon Snow when he was investigating the cholera epidemic. Had he stopped it at the point of telling people, you know, you just got to do a better job boiling your water. What's wrong with you people? But Jon Snow didn't stop there. You know, he instituted changes in the water system of London. And we conquered diseases like cholera in the modern world. You know, had he left it up to people to boil their water, we would still be having cholera epidemics. Why is this any different? But Americans are, and that includes all of us actually, are very susceptible to the idea that really this comes down to personal responsibility. You know, that, and indeed, how can you argue with this? We do need to be more active. We do need to take a greater responsibility for our diets. But is that what he's saying here? No, he's not saying that. He's saying, don't consider a tax on Coca-Cola, is what he's saying. That would be counterproductive. You don't need to do that. People just need to take better care of themselves. Well, what's our experience with tobacco? What did we learn from tobacco? We learned that it was when we started to make broad, you know, we didn't just focus on telling smokers to quit, but we made smoking very expensive. We socially stigmatized it by making smokers go outside. We did a lot of things at the community level. That's when we started to see dramatic differences in smoking rates. I like this quote. As a culture, we seek to insist, despite much powerful evidence to the contrary, that health behaviors such as smoking, diet, and exercise are a simple question of individual agency, personal fortitude, and the exercise of free will. You know, as physicians, we continue to behave that way when we're giving people advice, particularly people who are dealing with a wide array of adversity. They are not living within the conditions with which it makes sense for us to give them that kind of advice. Because we're assuming that it just is a matter of their free will. Now, why is it that we operate that way? Well, the psychologists have looked at this, and the social researchers, and the model that they propose for this is something called the right choices model, which is to say that our character, upbringing, and education impact on our mindset, priorities, and knowledge, and influence are making good choices which lead to positive incomes, or bad choices which lead to negative outcomes. And of course, you know, at some level, that is truly how we all see the world, right? I mean, when good things happen to us, we tend to look at ourselves and say, look at me, you know, that was all my hard work, right? And when bad things happen to us, it's an interesting thing. We tend to then look outside of ourselves and say, that wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been for this. But when we look at other people, we don't do that. We tend to assume that it's because of faults of their own that they ended up sick. And this right choices model has been demonstrated to be the operant model that in all of our way of looking at the world. So that when we present data, as James did, and as many of you have seen time and time again about health disparities between group A and group B, group A having better health and group B having worse health. So for example, in the slides James showed, Native Hawaiian kids are far more likely to be obese than white kids. The general public, when shown that data, will simply assume that it was group B's bad choices that led to them to have worse health. So that we have to, you know, data is a good thing. But we are highly naive if we think repetitive reiterations of that sort of data are going to make a difference in how the general public wants to respond to that data. Because, again, they are going to assume that the bad outcomes are as a result of bad behaviors. And that's what the CEO of Coca-Cola is playing on. He understands that very well when he says that. That's a very receptive message. The tobacco companies used it too. Indeed, and if as a scientific matter we look at the question, has personal responsibility waned? I mean, that would be the question for the... Oh, so it's a matter of people just not being responsible anymore? That's why we're seeing this flurry of obesity? Well, no. I mean, if you look at a variety of health behaviors, intercourse without a condom, alcohol use, riding with a drunk driver, and not wearing your seatbelt, the trend has been steadily downwards over time. People are, in fact, behaving in more responsible ways in most areas of their life. The elephant in the room. I mean, as a physician, again, I feel that we are terrified to acknowledge the elephant in the room so often. It's like Pandora's box. What do you do if you open up questions that you don't feel like you have the capacity to do anything about? Why would you talk about neighborhood conditions, conditions of poverty, homelessness, domestic violence, when you, that's beyond either your training or the amount of time you're allocated in the room or any sense that you have that you can do something about it. So we don't talk about it, and we don't acknowledge it. And we have to change that, because I think it starts by being honest about it. So humor me for 1 second while I show you one of the elephants in the room.
later, they've got the spirit, they've always fixed plays on everything. The whole shebang, start to finish, why we feel miserable, why we buy stuff we don't need, why we eat too much, drink too much, hurt people, whoa, whoa, even kill people. Whoa! It explains why 1 in 10 children in the UK have a mental illness. 1 in 10. And what's causing all of this is just one thing. But apparently, I'll tell you about it in under 3 minutes because everyone's so busy they can't spare any more time. Even a frame that explains everything. Get on with it! Alright, calm down, I'm getting to it. So, basically, as I was saying, the author... This book discovered that there is one common cause which increases almost all the social problems in a developed society. One cause, just one, a single overriding factor that makes almost everything worse. You name it, it's worse. Homicide.
Sorry, it's our internet connection.
Is it the hospital's internet?
It's mental health, teenage births, obesity, imprisonment, drug dependence, social mobility, life expectancy. All are significantly worse, but the effect of one thing. One.
I wonder if we can buffer it by just pausing.
Who thought it? And it's so simple. You ran out of time! I'm doing a build-up. Can't you see that? Amateurs. So, where was I? See? I've lost my train of thought now.
Well, I'd be happy to share the link.
2 seconds.
There we go, for this video.
Did you know that people were friends? Trying to catch cold, and people in good intimate relationships heal quicker.
We can
send everybody the link.
Yeah, we'll send you all the link. It's an incredible website. If you're interested in easy access to an incredible amount of data around the social determinants model, this is the place to go now. TheEqualityTrust.org. Here's what he was trying to show. This is a slide about obesity by country, comparing the percent obese to income inequality, social class. And as you can see, the trend line is this nice, steep line. If you do the same thing by state in the United States, and the data's there on their website, you'll see the same thing by states, comparing income inequality to the percent obese in the population. You can do this for virtually every disease that exists out there, comparing income inequality to those illnesses, and you'll see the same nice line up there. Here we are, United States of America, most obese, highest income inequality in the world. For a developed country. So the question is, if we wanted to develop a community-based framework for the prevention of disease and the promotion of health, what would it look like? I think that is why many of the people in the room here are here today, is that question. And I love this quote from Leonard Syme, who is the fellow who did the Mr. Fit study. How many of you here remember Mr. Fit? Largest medical public health trial ever done in the world. They started out, they screened 60,000 individuals to enroll 12,000, and those individuals got advice on diet, tobacco cessation, and exercise. And after many years and many hundreds of millions of dollars, they showed nothing. Syme, instead of killing himself, actually decided to make a career out of figuring out why that was and what was going on with that. So I love this quote. He said, the first job in developing a framework would be to identify the most important population determinants of disease. Where should we focus our attention? He said, we know the answer to this question, but until very recently, we haven't wanted to talk about it. The most important social determinant of disease is social class. It's an overwhelmingly important risk factor for disease since the beginning of recorded time. I mean, Virchow James, who James quoted, that was in the 1800s. I mean, he was fired. You know, the German community that brought him in to understand why people were dying of all these infectious diseases, when he came back to them and he said, well, I can tell you why they're dying. You've got terrible taxation policies. And and there's huge disparities in wealth. And they fired him. They said, you know, that's not what we wanted to hear. But, you know, that's 200 years ago. As Syme said, we're not sure what to do about it. If revolution is the only useful intervention to remedy the ills of the social class, it's not surprising that we have pursued more straightforward research. So the healthcare social class gradient has been seen for virtually every disease that has been studied. And this has been proven from studies like Whitehall, which if you're not familiar with it, please go look at it. Brilliant study. Got a guy, the guy who did it, a knighthood for doing it. But to the Oscars, I mean, how many people in this room know that if you win an Oscar, your life expectancy is about 2 years longer than if you were nominated for an Oscar? I mean, the thing about this social class thing is that it's not either you have it or you don't. It's a gradient from the, and that's what Whitehall first showed. It's a gradient from the bottom to the top. If you're the vice president and not the CEO, sorry, but your health is not going to be as good as the guy above you. We know that to be the case. So this affects all of us, unless you're that top dog. We're going to skip this slide in the interest of time. I think for our organization, one of the things we've, you know, wrestled with all of this is, what does that mean for a community organization? How do we approach this? And for us, it meant learning to tell a different story. We couldn't continue to just dispense advice. And not only did we have to tell a different story, we had to listen to different stories in our community. And so one of our approaches to that has been to get to the back of Kluge Valley. We have 100 acres of land. State park land, and we've been on it now for about 6 years, working with the community hand in hand to reclaim that land. And because one of the important stories in Kluge Valley is a story of people losing their connection to land. That's a story that's important throughout Hawaii. It's obvious to many of us that that's the story for the Native Hawaiian community, but it's also the story for most of the immigrant groups that are coming to us from Polynesia, Micronesia, Philippines, and whatnot. These are people who had, up until their recent immigration, a strong connection, a daily connection with the land. And so we're trying to re-explore that. And we're trying to also come to terms with the meaning of some of the ancient wisdom that exists here in this place, as this Olelo tells us, the breath of the land is the life of the people. So our nature preserve is known as Ho'u Lu'aina. It's our mission is to be a welcoming place of refuge where people of all cultures can sustain and propagate the connections between the health of the land and the health of the people. And just to show you a few slides briefly about some of the things we do, almost all of the work on the land, 100 acres turns out to be a pretty big piece of land, almost all of the work is being done with volunteers. And this is a typical volunteer group that has come up to the land. We start by everyone circles up and we introduce ourselves. We talk a little bit about why we're there. We bring an ancestor with us. We ask everyone who comes to introduce someone who is there with them that day to acknowledge the connection to the people who come before us. We're planting palo. We have extensive gardens now. In the future, we'll hopefully have upwards of 40 acres of gardens planted. We're really, you know, within the community, trying to come in a very physical way to an understanding of what it means to work together. You know, the word collaborate, which we use all the time, it's know, you can't get a, write a grant application nowadays, as most of you know, if you don't have some sort of collaboration built into it. But to collaborate means, collaborate means to work together, right? And that's what we're doing physically. Here's a bucket train, people bringing mulch up into one of the gardens. This is a group of our first gardeners on the land. Was a group of Chukis women who were in a diabetes group that we've been running. We had this diabetes group going for about a year down at our health center when the interpreter for the group told the group leader one day, she said, you know, I know you keep on pushing on this idea of exercise for this group of women, but we actually don't have the word exercise in the Chukchi language. The group leader, instead of kind of going, what? You know, she said, do you have the word for gardening? Because we had just gotten onto the land at that point in time, and she said, yeah. Well, could you ask them how many people would be interested in gardening? Every hand in the room shot up. Within a week, this group of women were up there clearing the land here and planting, and had, within a few months, harvested their first harvest of sweet potato and corn and the like, and have been coming up there since. We've been able to document steady improvements in their health and, you know, in more scientific ways through things like hemoglobin A1C and the like. We're very interested in, this is my wife, my little boy when he was very little, we're, you know, getting families to come and spend time together, so we do definitely encourage people to come generationally. And the work that we do is, here's a group of kids, some from the mainland, actually, and some from Hawaii, working on in a valley which was has ancient rock walls. It was extensively planted in the distant past, and they are cutting down invasive species and bringing that land back into production. I've always been struck by this slide. Most of you know From Neurons to Neighborhoods. And to me, the essence of From Neurons to Neighborhoods is this quote that human relationships and the effects of relationships on relationships are the building blocks of healthy development. They were talking about infants and young children here, but I think this is true for all of us. So how do we promote healthy relationships? Here's, in that vein, here's just a partial list of some of the community partners that have been working with us back in the land. These are the organizational partners. The list of individuals is in the thousands now. I want to finish with this quote from Marmot and Wilkinson. It is not simply that poor material circumstances are harmful to health. The social meaning of being poor, unemployed, socially excluded, or otherwise stigmatized also matters. As social beings, we need not only good material conditions, but from early childhood onwards, we need to feel valued and appreciated. We need friends, we need more sociable societies, we need to feel useful, we need to exercise a significant degree of control over meaningful work. Without these, we become more prone to depression, drug use, anxiety, hostility, and feelings of hopelessness, which all rebound on our physical health. This is the essence of the social determinants model. I guess the question comes back to all of us. How are we going to accept that challenge and move forward? Thank you.
Okay, Ben, we'll get you out of time. Well, that says it's already, my watch says it's still 25 past. But I did want to point out, we have this, we gave you guys this handout. This is the Robert Wood Johnson's commission,
breaking through on social determinants of health and health disparities. And I guess one of the big challenges that we've found, and David alluded to it, when you start talking about these big societal issues, you know, it becomes overwhelming. And when we did our first training using unnatural causes and put this out, one of the feedback we got was, well, gee, you know, what can I do about it? You know, it's like most people want to feel like they have some action steps that they can move forward on. And I think a lot of this, what I've come across in reading and starting to think through this is, how do we frame messages about these things? And how do people think, like Dave was saying, what's the American mindset? Because, you know, again, for me, what you have to do if you want to have an impact is usually influence policy changes. And examples of this are, you know, and I look at some of our partner organizations, you know, like the One Voice Coalition and CAHEA and some of these folks. What are they concerned about? Well, they're concerned about seeing, you know, ag land converted into another big housing tract and adding more cars, you know, bringing in more people from outside Hawaii. You know, certain specific policies can really make a difference in terms of whether this we continue on this path that we're going on with ever bigger growth, or whether we start to have an influence on changing things and making spaces available. I had to wait for 2 years to get a little community garden plot. You know, why is it like that? Why can't we have more of those kinds of plots? Why can't we make what David's done up in the back of Kalihi Valley, why can't we start moving that downstream and making that more about that? And if you listen to the people in the community, I'm sure that's what you're going to hear that they would like to see. So I think, you know, as a group, one of my frustrations has been that even though I work in a program that works on health disparities, it's siloed, because I'm supposed to work with the Micronesian community. And I, you know, and we all tend to be like that. And I was talking to May about that. It's what we see in, when we go to meetings, and most of the meetings are the people that already know this stuff telling each other that it's important. We need to start telling the story outside of our circle of, you know, healthcare providers and public health people. And so what this paper talks about is a lot of the research, and there's starting to be a body of evidence on what is effective ways to do this. And what they came up with this commission, Robert Wood Johnson's commission, and through several focus groups, and you can look at the whole paper, but with these three themes, the problem on the messaging around the problem of health disparities in America. And the first theme is that America spends more on health care, and we see this a lot in the unnatural causes. We're spending all this money, and we're up to like 40-something now, 46 in the world in terms of our health outcomes. It's not working. You know, we need a new paradigm. All Americans don't have the same opportunities to make healthy choices. And these barriers, you know, to making healthy decisions are too high for an individual to overcome. You just can't tell people to be healthy and you know, we need another brochure that says, follow these recommendations. Those things aren't going to work. And then good health requires individuals to make personal choices and requires a societal commitment to remove the obstacles to preventing these things. So what are the obstacles that are out there? You can't make those choices without changing those. Then the second theme is the importance of social determinants of health. Our zip code may be more important than our genetic code. You know, the idea that, you know, I was going to mention something earlier, you know, this when I was first started my career in the Pacific, people were talking about the thrifty gene theory. You know, well, the reason Pacific Islanders are fat is because of this thrifty gene theory. You know, it's all about the genetics. It has nothing to do. We need to, you know, get rid of that idea or that paradigm and start acknowledging that it's where people live and the resources that they have. Person's health and chances of becoming sick and dying are greatly influenced by the powerful social factors that they're dealing with. There's more to health than healthcare. You know, this is a thing that I especially feel. And there's another video produced by Unnatural Causes that I haven't seen, or by California Newsreel, called "The Money Making Medicine." You know, and I mean, a lot of it, and speaking to a lot of doctors, one of the biggest problems we have is that we really live in a medical model society where most of our resources go into that. And one of my frustrations has been with the Hawaii Public Health Association, you know, we really struggle living out of a shoebox to try to get programs to work, whereas the Hawaii Primary Care Association has about 13 or 14 staff that are funded because they're dealing with medical things. And so there's money for medicine. But there hasn't been a lot of support for these public health approaches, and it's harder to bring everybody together around that. So we need to realize that to really have any impact on health, we've got to start looking outside of just medical solutions. And then the commission's call to action is that healthcare reform is essential, again, but improving the health of Americans requires much more than just medical care. And then we must find ways to enable more people to lead healthy lives and avoid getting sick in the first place. There's a lot of other really good information around framing, depending on the kinds of mindsets people have, whether people have the self-made man sort of ideas, you know, when it comes down to politics. But I really think that we've talked about this within our cohort. We're all sort of doing this, but it's David's frustration and all of our frustration is just a lot of busy people that are just doing this in their spare time, you know, and we'll have much more impact if we could form an alliance around health equity, where when we go to the legislature, and you know, Representative Josh Green was the last speaker at the Hagel-Liao conference, and again, his message was all about healthcare. We need to get providers and things like that, and it's really difficult to get, I think, our legislators to pay attention to this, and the only way they're going to pay attention is if they see that there's a lot of voters out there that are interested in this and are asking them to pay attention to it. Bottom line is, when you go to a legislator, he wants to know how many votes you have within his district. So, you know, and I think that's what the discussion we wanted to do. And I want to put in a plug for the White Public Health Association. You know, we went through a strategic planning about a year and a half ago. And really, I think under Kavika's leadership, and I don't know if I mentioned, you know, he is the director of the Office of Health Equity. You know, he's the right guy to has a passion for this. And I think that our association could play a major role as a focal point for this. It's the right role for, I think, a public health association to look at this. And we need something like that, I think, to have a way to bring together the alliance. There has to be some glue for all this and someone that kind of can be the champion to lead it forward. But that's really, I think, all that we have. I am a little bit over because I have one. Oh, I'm sorry. There's one more slide here. And this is actually in the document. But this just talks about some of the considerations for framing messages. You know, but this slide really, I think, is like the great example of what we often do in public health, but it's really a bad example. You know, it's how we use data, how we show data oftentimes. This, you know, sort of, if you look at this, this is the line for the APIs, and of course there's been a tremendous amount of work led by the Native Hawaiian community to disaggregate the Asian Pacific Islander grouping. But if you look at the data in this way, oh, well, there's not that much of a problem, you know. And it sort of relates back to the same things what we're talking about. We need to really talk about data and, you know, show things in a different way. So, you know, how are we able to, you know, challenge conventional wisdom with unexpected facts? And I think that's one thing David's talk does a good job. It kind of talks about things that people in the health don't really always talk about. We got to get away from just putting up a bunch of disease rates and be more creative. And there's a lot of resources out there. The Spirit Level, there's a book called Spirit Level that you can get a hold of and read and get more information on this. So that's it.
Thank you. So thank you to James and David for coming all this way across town to present to us. We will send you those links. Please leave us your email address. And again, if you need parking and the CME credit, it's there. We'd like to invite whoever wants to stick around for, we're going to be kind of brainstorming on what are some of the next steps that these alliances, like all of you in this room who are interested in this topic, can actually do some action steps in the next several months, couple of years, because we've been talking about these issues for a while now, and how do we move forward and use each other, even though we're all super busy. And I think many of us think that it's got to take some policy steps and, again, collaboration. So I invite all of you to stay, if you can, for a few more minutes, and we're going to be talking a little bit more about this. And if you can't stay, to please leave us your contact information, and we will try to keep this together. So, okay? Great.
And for those of you who are leaving, if you want to follow up, HawaiianPublicHealth.org is our website. That's one way that you can communicate with the Zico.
Okay. Residents got to go back to work.
Just keep them warm.
If anybody needs to use the restroom, there's one around the corner. You just follow the hallway.
Just saw him at lunch last
week. So those of you who are staying, maybe we could just kind of form a semicircle. If you take your chairs around, so you can kind of see each other's faces.
I'm Dr.
Dodd Simon, I'm out there here. I'll get back to the medical student, I'll Fred at one ankle something.
Keith Matsumoto, Federal Pediatrics. I'm on the hospital board.
James Rare with the White Public Health Association, and I also work at the Pacific Center for Elimination of Disparities, JAMS, the Department of Family Medicine. Dr. Neil Palafox is at P93.
Okihiro, I'm Matt Holmstein, and we're with the Department of Pediatrics. I'm also at Wainai Kapa. So I just thought it would be good, since people are here who are kind of somewhat like-minded, to kind of brainstorm about what you guys think are some things that we could do, some concrete action steps. We did this at the Hei Julia Department of Native Hawaiian Health Conference over the weekend, talking about action steps. But this is a different group, and I wanted to get some of your ideas on thoughts of what could conceivably happen over the next several months, because I think many of us get paralyzed by, like you guys were talking about, the scope of the problem and really what can be done. So I'm going to open it up to James and David to see what some
may, in terms of the parameters of your question, particularly pertaining to childhood obesity, is that right?
They do in that framework, but I also recognize that these things are really, the issue is much wider than that. And I think all of us who work in these communities realize that. And so it can be as basic as supporting breastfeeding legislation, soda tax legislation, or housing legislation, or just with getting the commitment that we're gonna keep this networking happening and how we can optimize that.
At a personal level, I mean, I think for me, the starting point is sort of self-awareness and self-education and the commitment to try. Once you have a better sense for yourself of what the data shows, and you can't help but wait until the data and not be overwhelmed by it. And my own experience with it, actually, in the last few years has been, how is it that I got through medical school and haven't been bombarded by all that? Because this is not new data. I mean, as we saw, Virchow was talking about this, almost 100 years ago. It's 150 years ago. I mean, it's been around for a while. Why is it that we are so steadfastly ignoring it? So James mentioned a couple of resources. One, Unnatural Causes DVD has been very useful for our organization. I mean, we did make a point. We do have Friday morning meetings, and we did make a point of showing that, presenting that video to the entire staff. It's a video of very high production value, so people who are used to seeing really costly things, that, it's very well made. It's not at all amateurish, which really helps. So. I would, if any of you are interested in doing that in groups, at home or whatnot, I would, the only caution I think those of us in our cohort would offer is that have plenty of time to debrief, because it's quite overwhelming, and the very first episode is about 50 minutes, the rest are about 20 minutes, so they're much more bite-sized, they're about the right size that you can do it in a staff meeting or something. But that first episode, I made the mistake of having everyone, not everyone in our organization, but about half of our staff, about 75 people walked out of the room, on a Friday looking like they'd just been bludgeoned, and it wasn't any fun for them. But thereafter, we always made a point of having a really good conversation around it so people could debrief a little bit and not be so traumatized by the experience of watching it, because it's really quite powerful, particularly if you're one of the people living in those circumstances, And I do, it would be, again, my one critique of it would be that there isn't enough positive message, because I don't think it's necessarily helpful to continue to tell stories, negative stories. I think we do an awful lot of that. We do all need to reach out to really stories of success and collaboration and friendship and relationship building, because we're all hungry for that. So I think the starting place is just to sort of commit to being better educated ourselves and then educating those around us. And so, I mean, our group has made that a commitment to continuing to try to do that with groups. So if anyone's interested, sits on a committee somewhere or has a group, you know, don't hesitate to call us. We're certainly not at the level of expertise at this that we'd like to be, nor are we really comfortable yet with the process of framing, because framing things, the message is incredibly important. There is, as James said, a lot of data about that now, that his message, not done well, will just fall in that year.
An example I would use of that is a basic health issue with the Micronesians, you know, and you know, looking at the testimony and things, I mean, it's, you know, I really would almost like to measure some of the, you know, take a look at these testimonies and measure them against what, you know, I've been reading are effective and ineffective ways of framing messages, you know, and becoming a bit better at that. But, you know, the other thing is, as I said, what are the critical things that are moving us forward or backward in terms of this issue, and I think that that's another thing, is setting a policy agenda, and that's really hard in public health because it's so big. There's just so many things, and I was trying at the beginning of this legislative session to do what I used to do for the Department of Health and create a sheet and track all these measures, you know, and things like that. And I was really struggling in terms of, especially with this session, because a lot of it was about holding on to money for programs that were already there. So, you know, the tobacco settlement, which is a really important thing, but I mean, it was all about keeping our money and proving that what we do is really good. So there wasn't a lot of, let's look broadly at these things and look at things that are outside of our area, you know, which are things like, you know, what's going to happen with the use of land, you know. And it's not always legislation, but it's land use commission sometimes, and things come up off your radar screen, things like that. But I do think that there's would be a lot of value in bringing folks together who are interested in this, in, you know, preparing a policy agenda, you know, that makes sense. And that's why I wanted to kind of point out that that's one thing Kubica's doing, and it's a daunting task, you know, but you gotta. No, I think that's one of the things, is to start getting people together. And
so a policy agenda to optimize the health of?
A policy agenda around health equity issues, these upstream issues, you know, not a policy agenda that says we need more doctors on the Big Island, you know, kind of thing. You know, it's important.
I just am reminded about the Bull School now has a whole Institute of Health Policy, and they kicked off their new program by inviting someone from Alameda County.
Yeah, that's the Tony Iton they were talking
about. Yep. Tony, oh,
and Dina Sheck was actually here from the law school, which
you know was part of it.
Yeah.
Right, I mean, well, they ought to be
absolutely
a group like this, because they've got a lot going on in exactly this area. Yeah.
And the dean is very supportive of it.
Yeah.
Are you guys working with Tony?
Yeah, I'm more actually personally, I mean, because I'm an alum of that school too. So, I mean, for example, one of the things we're looking at is a mental health law class, I mean, which is a medical thing, but a lot of people don't know that, you know, the people with the worst inequities in Hawaii are people seriously persistent with mental illness. I mean, with 10 to 15 years less life expectancy. But the flip side of that is that the people, when people are involved in the criminal justice system and they have seriously persistent mental illness, unfortunately, the people who are charged with defending them, which most are public defenders, have terrible attitudes, just like everyone else has terrible attitudes with people who are seriously persistent mental illness. So one of the things is just getting people together and learn about what is the law about mental health. You know, how can we work better with mental health court and things like that for both healthcare professionals, for students, and also law people and whoever else. Another thing is, you know, speaking of the law, One of the framing things, and I think in moving the dialogue away from disease and to health, is to focus on human rights. Because we have the human right to health. It's been defined since 1948 in the Constitution of the World Health Organization as the most holistic thing. Healthcare is like a tiny part of that human right to health. I mean, it's housing, it's education, it's environment, it's a most inclusive human right. And I think that if people, if we teach that, if we start to teach human rights instead of what we teach usually in the United States, which is civil rights, then we start to say, oh, that's why, because it also draws the connections. I mean, when we talk about this, it draws the connections between the fact that I live in a cruddy house, which is full of roaches and rats, and my kids all have asthma, and, you know, and there's mold and things like that. You know, so it's just, there's a disease model, but it's also like, oh, well, that's why it's so hard for me to sleep at night, because I live near the freeway and things like that, and that's, you know, impacting things. And, like, if people had a healthy living, or we talk about the fact of how much housing is occupied by military, and how that impacts upon the cost of housing and rental here.
I mean, so how would you see that in terms of helping to shape the... is the law school working on something that around this issue of health equity policy or setting a policy agenda?
Well, you know, I mean, that was my question when you say they have a health policy group. I wonder what the real focus is, if it's health care reform policy, you know, which is...
It has been more of that. Yeah. I mean, the meetings that they've had so far. But there are, like, for example, there's a Native Hawaiian Center for Excellence there. And I mean, I know personally I'm working on a project with them to promote the issue of human rights. So I think that the law school is a great institute, is a great resource. But, you know, it's also it's also people in the community. You know, it's not just professionals. And I think that that's another of the focuses that we have to get away from. It's not just, you don't have to be a professional to be involved.
No, we're just saying that that's a partner of potential.
Well, one other thing I wanted to just point out, because Kahea, which is really an environmental justice group, you know, the word, they've been approaching HPHA. They want to do these, like, bus tours to Waianae, and Kavika organized in Health Equity Summit last year, both bus tours here, which went up to the valley, but also went around Waikiki and kind of said, historically, well, this is what this place used to be, and because of policies, this is what it is now. But I think with Miwa Tamanaha, who's the executive director of Kahea, she really wants to be able to get folks to break bread with the people in the community that have already thought about a lot about what they want to do. And what Dave's trying to do in Kalihi Valley is bring the people together that already know what their issues are and tell people that could advocate on their behalf and have a stronger voice. Because, again, for me, it's like, you know, we're not going to get anywhere if we continue to talk in small pockets about this. We need, you know, if I can say, well, you know what, I've got, you know, this group, whether it's the Filipino Nurses Association or the Hawaii Nurses Association or, you know, the Hawaii Public Health Association or the Native Hawaiian, you know, health systems, you know, to where we can really start to speak with a bigger voice and say, here's who these people are, and sign things and say, this has got to stop or whatever, you know. And the one thing that Josh said was a point well taken is well-written emails to policymakers around these issues. You can have an impact, you know, if you do a good job of articulating and making your case.
I wonder maybe perhaps on that same theme, broadening this group might be to more actively engage medical students. Speaking as a student, the issues of social justice and social determinants are really sort of off the radar of medical students for a number of reasons. The socioeconomics of medical students themselves, the issue that David brought up, which is a very good one, that we get inundated at JAPSM with numbers. Because I think JAPSM wants to put a check next to the box of social justice, they give us all the epidemiological numbers about how the Native Hawaiians are more prone to obesity, these kinds of things. But they never go the step further to explain the mechanisms behind that. So as David pointed out earlier, what tends to happen is it's very easy then to just make the assumption that these are bad choices. Micronesians make bad choices. And that's what medical students are left with. So we're lucky enough as medical students to have Seiji Yamada, who's sort of the like the Obi-Wan Kenobi for the small group of medical students that are interested in social justice. But we really don't have many others that actively engage us. What I might suggest, if there are attending physicians in the room, is that you in addition to pimping your students about anatomy and physiology, you know, you can bring points up about what we just talked about today and just maybe start to get these ideas into the heads of medical students, because they aren't there at all for the the most part. And it's going to be hard to get sort of the next generation of physicians interested in these issues if there's no active engagement.
I thought they were being actively engaged in that homeless shelter right next door to Jefferson. Isn't that
The home project is there now. Whether there are the issues of why that particular population is there, whether those issues are discussed, or whether it's more of a here's a chance where I can actually take blood pressures and give shots and I could get hands on. People have their different reasons for getting involved in that.
Yeah, I agree. There needs to be a deeper understanding of that, and I've talked to David about that. But I actually was at a friend's house one night, and one of the medical students was there, and his comment was, "Well, I think we just need to send all these Micronesians back to Micronesia." You know, so there was no understanding of their history and what, you know, why they're there, and
I'd say that's the majority opinion of medical students that I know of.
Yeah. And that's really disturbing, I agree.
Well, one of the problems that I see is that obviously physicians should be more aware and more involved in and interested in resolving some of this. But, the medical school is populated here disproportionately by Ilani Punho and other graduate school graduates. And so I'm not surprised that some of the comments that you mentioned are there. If you want to look at it more broadly, you got to change the recruitment or the selection if you want to get political and go, take a broader approach to the whole medical aspect of this problem. But right now, it's just, we live in the medical model, myself.
Yeah.
And we look outside of it, obviously, but we're still basically physicians who are raised that way. And I hear even worse, fewer graduates are going into primary care. Mm-hmm. Vast majority into specialty care. So I don't hold a lot of hope for the way physicians have been trained and coming out of, their perspective. So in my mind, it's more about its policy, the law from advocacy groups that I think we're really going to have to make a change.
John Okamura talks about this just in general at the university and the policies that the university has adopted, which have led to fewer and fewer Hawaii students, and especially the Filipino Hawaiian students, from coming in. And it's been driven by economics, because if they can have more off-island students come in, they have higher tuitions, but he really feels that they've been in breach of their own policies of serving the people of Hawaii. But again, John, it's interesting to write this because this is the stuff that we should be saying, and yet we're not, and we're when they're furloughing the students, and things. People have come to us and said, "Well, what could I say to help get our kids back in?" But the public health, we've been, unfortunately, quite silent, in terms of the impact that this is going to have long term. It's mostly been more the immediate stuff, what's the impact on parents when their kids aren't in school? But somebody needs to be talking about what's the impact on these kids, in terms of how long they're going to live if they don't graduate.
I think it's important that people in the medical community of Hawaii make that argument. I'm part of a little group that's been looking at this about where our medical students coming from. And when you actually get into the data, it's really quite shocking. So what you said about, they're coming from three high schools. When 60-70% of all medical students in the United States only medical school come from one of three high schools, that's kind of a shocking number. But when students are sort of making these arguments and digging into this data, it's pretty easy to shut them down. Those three schools control a lot of things, and we've been sort of shut down in that. I think it takes people that are established within the medical community to talk about these issues and maybe to try and get themselves on admissions committees.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things, Keith, I think you have a really valid point. And one of the things I know that in the Ahaue of Nakauka, the Hawaiian Physicians Organization, is that there is contest effort that It's not pressed as much because, of course, we have a lot of Kamehameha grants. But, but you know, really, like some of us, Martina, Deanna, myself, have really said, you know, it doesn't matter just for Hawaiian students. We have to get there and get and reach all kids from single families, from the public schools, and say, look, it's not just being a doctor. It's being anything other than a policeman, a cook, a janitor. You know, you're that just because you come from a public school or you come from a single family or no one else in your house, in your family has ever gone to college, doesn't mean that's not a possibility. And I think that that's really the key, is that a lot of it is like this dignity stuff, that, you know, everyone has dignity, and everyone, we need to respect everyone and have them have, you know, that no matter whether they choose to make that choice or not, they should have the ability to make those choices of being whatever they want to be. And I think that we, as healthcare professionals or students, we can play that role. We can go to the schools and we can give a little lecture, and us, if we look sort of like them, we can say, oh, you know what? I know where you're coming from. I was there, you know, 20, 30, you know, 40 years ago, and yet here I am today. And so you can be, I will pull you up. And not just like, you know, not just like, oh, you pull yourself up, but no, I will help pull you up. I think that's one of the commitments we can make. I said, I will help pull you up. Not just randomly someone, but I will help. Here's my number, here's my email. You need help, you know. And it's not like, unfortunately, it's not a public health intervention. It's more like an individual thing. But
I think these are all really good suggestions that the medical school does play a role in this. Their attitude and what is reflected and what actually happens there is important. I think we have influence and we can have a say using these physician organizations and our voice to talk to the chairs about getting their commitment, because we've got Elizabeth Tam, she's committed to this. We've got Marjorie Mao, we're getting a new chair.
Nursing, I mean, you know, nursing is much more progressive, social work much more progressive, oh, I don't know nursing, but it seems like, at least nursing seems much more progressive, at least parts of it. Social work definitely much more progressive, you know, so I'm not saying everyone plays a part, but that we can't focus so much on the physician that we forget that, you know, public health nurse is the first point of contact with many people. The dental assistants, which were all wiped out, those were the first point of contact. You know, the social workers, I mean, that there are schools where this ethic already exists. I mean, social work is part of the fabric. Mm-hmm. Yet, we don't have, there's not a social worker here. Oh, sorry.
I appreciate that because, you know, in terms of High Court, we have these collaborations. We've got these representatives all on our advisory. We focused a lot on educating providers, but I think there needs to be kind of a shift now towards what else can a provider do and what are their other influences that do besides just the office. So
I had a comment. In our small way, we were shifting back now to the community from what public health nurses were doing, whole stuff for reintervention. But now we were told go back to the communities, which we did a long time ago. So now we're having to get back to like Palolo housing. We work in the Palolo housing area and we've heard about your program there. And people are, you know, looking, and we're looking at trying to duplicate some of it in housing because of the health disparity stuff. We have a lot of Micronesian population. So we're starting to, just in our little way, maybe do, we started off, we got together with the Hansen's disease nurses who were doing screening in the area. And so we sort of, that's our foot in the door again, looking at ways to help that community. And we found out through just talking to them that they're very interested in exercise, dancing. We don't say exercise, we're going to say dance now, because they come out every week, and we're not there to do it all the time. We're trying to build sustainability. They've been coming out every week to do an exercise. We call it exercise, you know, we're trying to do more ethnic things with them. But the most of them are Micronesians that are coming out. We're looking at cooking, you know, classes. Food bank comes. every Wednesday, but the type of food, again, you save. They get the
pastry,
and all the leftovers. Sodas, all the leftovers. That's what gets dropped off at the housing, and that's what they go to go get, you know. So we're trying to maybe look at finding farms or in the area who might do, you know, fruits and vegetables. So in our, just in our small way, the community, that's where we're trying to look at.
Well, you know.
And Danny, too.
I want to bring up a big policy area, two words, school lunch.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a single issue area. It's a, almost like crystallization of all the issues that were brought up today. I'm just going to go down a quick list. Partly because the KCC is in the process of working with DOE, DOH to revamp the training for 210 schools, kitchens, workers over the next 3 years. So we're in a fact-finding stage and we've seen a lot of stuff. So I just want to go down a list is that in some way it is like an example of federally mandated supersizing. You know, one third or half the kids do not finish their lunch because the way they mandate the portion size, it's impossible for anyone, you know, any kids to finish it. The way the state managed the school lunch system by constantly reinterpreting and misinterpreting federal and state policies is a major, major issue. Example, we now have this offered versus served, which is, you know, you have to work on, supposed to be offering healthy choices versus just serving what you cook that day. The way the state interpreted it is that you can make a choice of accepting or not accepting a certain item.
Mm.
So if you don't want to accept salad that day, that's your choice. And the rationale behind, yes, salad nothing. So it's a negative choice. So the rationale behind that we heard is that they'll save money.
Mm.
They can cook less, knowing that what, you know, the pattern of rejection. The other issue is purchasing policy. Again, it's constantly, you know, misinterpreted. On different day, you know, when you talk to different people at the upper management level, one side will say they have the best buy policy, meaning they buy the cheapest, you know, item on the inventory list. So they can import anything from the mainland that is the cheapest. On the other hand, there is a local preference policy according to USDA, meaning that you can choose local, you know, product over a mainland product, which we're trying to see if they can do because, you know, that could be the biggest economic stimulus you can create.
Right.
You know, the school system can be the biggest, you know, customer for the farmers.
Yeah.
But that is also constantly being turned around and being, you know, basically they're constantly using the Best Buy policy as the one, the rationale for going for the cheapest.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they will say, well, because, you know, we're losing money, we got to raise lunch, you know, the school lunch cost. At the same time, every year they're spending $1 to $2 million warehousing free commodities given to them by the USDA.
Mm-hmm.
Because the people are not
warehouse.
Yeah, full warehouse.
Wow.
Because they can, the workers are not trained, so they cannot use these products enough, including frozen blueberries,
mm-hmm.
which you can just sew into anything
mm-hmm.
and make it, and the kids will love it.
So it's a lot of refrigerated things.
A lot of refrigerated things, frozen stuff, yeah. $1 to $2 million spending on free food. Now, to add to that, when they cannot draw down from this free food, they cannot request more free food from the federal government. So you may say that, you know, you're losing twice as much, you know, by not being able to use that. Again, no one's looking at, has looked into this, and no one has kind of addressed this. Maybe everyone's thinking, you know, just too big a problem to address, but I don't think so. But to me, you know, this is the time that maybe a group like this can start chipping at some of these issues. The other one is messaging. We've been talking to a lot of managers saying, we try to offer healthy choices, but the kids don't like it. You know, on the day we offer chicken nuggets, the kids cheered. You know, after several days of healthy choices. Part of it is messaging. You know, what is more powerful when you see on the TV? You know, it's cooler to get something that is, you know, processed and it's more hip to, you and look at the kids channel, right? You know, all the processed food, the candy commercials.
The biggest foundation in the country currently spending money on the childhood obesity is Heart of UJ. Their annual budget is $100 million. By January 4th each year, the industry has spent more money on advertising to children. January 4th, the first 4 days of the year, they've already spent more money.
So,
UJ is a little bit outgunned here.
We are in some way, you know. But at the local level, the managers are saying, we need help in getting the message through to teachers, the principals. If we can have constant messaging in the school system to help us reinforce the idea.
We have to improve the coolness factor.
In fact, just on that note, four organizations are meeting next week, Kanu Hawaii, Kukua Hawaii Foundation, KCC, and Melanie Kosaka, share your table to look at some of these issues. And one of the projects we want to throw at them is the messaging project, with Melanie Kosaka being, you know, really, you know, well-known producer and highly skilled. And Kanu, instead of community, getting the, you know, people out there to do projects. And that's something maybe we can, you know, also work with you folks to come in and help with the messaging.
Having a pediatrician serve on the thing. I mean, there's a natural fit.
Exactly. I mean, everyone in this room probably can contribute to this kind of messaging project in many different ways. So yeah, exactly. We kind of, one idea is that, you know, produce 30 seconds to 1 minute commercials about healthy food. You know, using the same tactic, except looking at bring in the Hawaii football team and get them to talk about, you know, what they're eating, you know, and then make it cool, make it snazzy, make it MTV style, get the message out.
Actually, you and I sit on a committee, the Healthy Communities, run by the YMCA, but we had a discussion about that warehouse,
right?
Because they don't seem to want to use it, and there's trying to, can you redeploy some of this food for the homelessness, the homeless issue, and all those types of things. But I just wanted to make a couple comments from looking at it from a community point of view. One of the things that was during the Cayetano administration, which a bunch of us got together and said, well, the problem we learned from the pediatricians, the kids weren't drinking enough water. Because in most of the elementary schools, I'm focusing most of the elementary schools, as we've all seen, the schools are not being kept up to speed as far as how they're being maintained. And most of the water fountains are
broken
or green with mold, and kids won't go near them. And then, of course, the secondary issue is because they're afraid to go to the bathroom, so they don't want to drink too much water, so they're not going to go to the bathroom. So there's a whole, with kids, there's a whole politics of water.
Right.
And if, you know, I just said, well, you know, how many of those little water fountains, how many of them can you put in a 40-foot container, and you just go find the best deal we can, bring it over, and just go out and repair all those things, you know, as a public policy.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It went nowhere, but I just tried to, it's a...
We offered to do it at Farrington High School. We were going to raise the money to do that, and we couldn't go anywhere.
Get anywhere, and the kids...
Yeah, we had to do it.
And there was the FACE group, the church group FACE, their kids went, the kids they had from McKinley High School went and testified for the city council and the legislature on this whole issue around water and the bathrooms. And, you know, it was this, it's this amazing cycle. That's a community thing that you'd think you'd be able to
make the traction on.
The other issue is the this sort of fun things at the local level. If you can work with their communities, more things happen when communities come together to do certain. And the best example was the Waipahu Community Association with the public health nurses in Waipahu asked us for a grant. And the project was the UKUS project. And the whole problem was you had little kids running delinquent all over this one apartment complex because they weren't in school. And the reason they weren't in school is they all had UKUS and the teachers were sending them home. And they're all Micronesian kids, and the parents, who have very little value for elementary education, would just let them run all over the street. So the nurses all got together, came up with their own, all those different oils they use and combs, and put together these kits and started going into the homes. training the parents of how to get rid of the cuckoo so the kids can stay in school. It's one of those, but it came from truancy that started out as a, you know, but, and along the way, the public health nurses having access to those apartments where you might have, you know, several generations all in one small apartment, we're finding grandma with severe untreated diabetes, mm-hmm. you know, that type of thing. But it was at the community level, people taking action at the community level, and those people are the ones that you really need to, when they've got something going, is, you know, they need to be supported, because that's, it's got to grow from inside of some of these communities mm-hmm. to get things happening.
I think that there was a Huku video that came out of that.
Yeah.
So now we use it for all our training for the health
yeah.
aides and the
school. Really?
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, it's an amazing, I've got, you know, I have to send in to the National Blue Cross Blue Shield, I have to send in a list of grants, and they picked out the Uku's grants and put it in a feature, and they left the word Uku's in the title, you know, so I was getting all these emails from people across the country, now what exactly is so, but those are some innovation at the local level. People, there's people out there in the communities thinking about things all the time, trying to figure out that they need support, and they need policy
exactly.
assistance to get things done.
Right.
So the face people are interesting in how what they lobby for,
yeah.
Especially in their communities, housing and things.
Okay.
Maine, what's the next step? I mean, how do people? I mean, how do we build an appropriate forum to keep these ideas alive and allow people to contribute their energy and expertise and to learn from one another?
Yeah. I think, one, we could take advantage of the internet. I mean, people talk about Facebook and websites all the time and blogs, and I think there's a role in that.
Yeah.
You know, I've thought about KANU because it's already there, and they do have these
right.
you know, groups.
Right.
And maybe that's an avenue, and since you're already connected with them, maybe we should talk to them about that
yeah.
and learn from them. Because we actually met with these wall-to-wall designers because they're helping us redevelop our webpage, and boy, they had some great ideas. He showed us how he twitters and how
yeah.
they gathered all these people and got these discussions.
We have to remember that there's still a digital divide.
Yeah,
that,
yeah.
You know, I mean,
yeah.
we're talking about some people. I mean, you talk about the people next door to the medical school in Kapa'ako.
Yeah.
They don't have a Facebook.
Yeah. No, I completely realize that. I also realize, though, that a lot of people have cell phones.
Well, text messaging actually
yeah.
has been shown. I don't know if people know, follow, like, there's been a lot of research in APHA and other journals showing that text messaging in India, for example, where there's not internet, but there's very, very poor people who still have a phone.
Yeah.
Text messaging is a very effective way of getting a message out.
Yeah.
I mean, it has to be short, it has to be, but yeah, I mean, just to
yeah.
make sure that we think of things like that instead of.
I actually just kind of watching this launch of civilbeat.com, and that's that new online news that Pierre Omidyar has started, and they just funded a program or an organization called SMS something, but their whole thing is creating social change through texting and that sort of thing. But I think keeping the message alive, keeping the discussion alive, and the networking, using the network, because I think that's what we're going to be very powerful, or most powerful, is important, and using different kind of avenues. So I recognize that communities aren't all connected through the digital media, but that we should use both. And, you know, creating some leadership that's going to help us there. So I think you guys are part of it. I think it's here. I think it's also in other places. You know, the Hei Huliao had lots of a similar discussion. And in the end, I think everyone said this discussion needs to keep going. I think you guys are a powerful voice.
Yep.
And so I will summarize kind of what we've talked about here. I will also give you a summary of what went on at Hei Huliao so you can see the connection. And we will talk with KANU and kind of next steps about what we can do. Yeah, and I, you know, welcome your suggestion.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for
staying.
Our medical support, as you know, is kind of like actively trying to disagree with my so we don't get to know when we were like, we're never going to be
No, I appreciate your support and your thoughts about all of that. Bringing it all together now.
All right.
Did you get your card?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
So,
we work under the radar, so we don't have to worry about getting permission or national organizations.
So we can just the problem is not 35.
The nurses, you guys are like on Mars to us, you know, we don't connections at all.
I know.
By the way, you're kidding me. Why is that? Well, because we just haven't had adequate training.
Because y'all have mutual law school friends.
Why did they get training?
Oh, right.
It's so hard. It's
like, I know.
You guys are like barred. You guys are barred from all the places we go, right?
Well, so third year, it's kind of such a big thing. Of course, just kind of
gets on the floor.
That's been forcing us to go off island.
Because the formula is so much better than the pediatricians are hurt. They want to get the data. And I just.
Yeah, definitely.
But so, you have ways that you should get it. And what you should do is, rather than
the people who come to this point. Yeah, so the problem is, I mean, we have a social justice, which is good means, and no one comes because realistically, apart from the five students, it's five officers, no one else comes.
The real leverage.
Oh, so the meetings are difficult to get people to come.
Yeah,
you know what? Meetings are just fine.
I was just saying, happy Lonnie.
You know, this is the biggest group we've had.
That's why I was saying, I think it has to come from kind of above, meaning that doctors in the community have to sort of bring the issues up with students in like a pimping setting, because that's what medical students know, right? That's what they respond to. But, and I don't blame the students, because they've never been exposed to this before, and most of them come from a certain social class where it's not an issue.
Right.
I mean, so many students that have never been in
Born
and raised in Hawaii, in town.
Yes. But they've never gone past Waikele Shopping Center.
Right. You guys are doing what our medical school should be doing, and yet our medical school shuns you. So it's very strange.
So baby needs to go under lights.
Well, I think.
And that was the other thing. So let me say
bye, Alton.
So let's do lights more.
Email me from your SIG.
Aaron,
I've got you someone.
I thought you might come, but I guess you didn't come.
Yeah, those guys are all, they're taking tests and doing this and that. Yeah. They're trying to find a day.
Or maybe it was in Carver, so they could have the lights in the room. And my wife was next to my wife.
You know, what he thought that students might be able to do.
It's tough. I've been in this position. I was the head of the global health for a while. And trying to find, like, we'd have all these meetings, we'd have all these cool speakers come in, and just no one would go.
Yeah.
It's just totally off the radar.
Yeah.
I'm trying to find a way to, like, how do you get students engaged? So I learned it's not by offering lectures. People will get to come to because it's not on the radar.
Yeah.
We just want to find some other way.
But I think you're right. It's got to be integrated. Just like getting positions.
It is actually a really good issue.
How do you get a position, a clinician, to look outside of their practice? It's getting them to do something that
cuts across the great line.
Maybe won't do that.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some other interesting ones. Same thing with early childhood reading.
And with residents.
But
if you are exposed to issues of social justice, kind of work in your medical school residency, what are you going to do? You know, then you're going to start your practice when you're making $100,000. Forget about it.
We managed to get some of our students to start in that
Well, it's not about to make that connection. You feel it not just as an obligation or you're going to attend them, but you're not. It's like you feel it. You know, it's an experience that kind of gets to something meaningful. You know, like med school had the opportunity to go to church for 2 months.
Yeah, that's powerful.
It changed my life. But it's something like that. And I know it's not for everybody, but I think there's not enough of that.
I didn't really, I didn't know that. That
experience. Yeah, and when it's there, it tends to be superficial. Like I was saying, how they always talk about disparities, but not the mechanisms behind the disparities.
Thank you very, very much.
I think once again, it's
Okay. So look, okay. I'm going to request that you.